Welcome. You are listening to Cosmopod. I am Christian, and I'm joined by Matthew.
Hey, everyone.
And I'm also joined by author, historian, Jun Zhi.
Hi, everyone.
Hello. All right. So we are here to discuss Jun's book, From Commune to Capitalism. Matthew and I have both very recently read this book and have a lot of questions. It's a very fascinating book, mainly around decollectivization in China and the transition from kind of Maoist China, socialist China, to Deng Xiaoping's market reforms. So the subtitle of the book is How China's Peasants Lost Collective Farming and Gained Urban Poverty. So to begin, perhaps, Jun, I'd just like to ask you how you became interested in this particular historical topic and how that kind of developed for you.
Right. Again, I mean, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I've read Cosmonaut for quite some time, and I'm always very impressed with all the writings and all the interviews on the site. So it's great to be here. As for me, I majored in economics, both in my undergraduate and also at graduate school. The initial plan was to do something like finance or economic growth in the Marxian framework. So it's more academic in a sense. It's more, probably more math oriented in that sense. But as I got more involved in actual political dialogues, debates, in China primarily, I realized that there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done to combat some of the mainstream thoughts, particularly on the history of socialism everywhere, in Soviet Union, in China, everywhere. And one of those was this issue of decollectivization, which was widely perceived in China, as we have been taught in school, that it's just a very smart policy, which everyone loved, and eventually it brought a great progress to the Chinese society and increased the income of all the rural workers, and it paved the way for the great success of the Chinese economic reform. So that was something, it's like in this, even you can say it's the big obstacle or the elephant in the room. Whenever you talk about socialism, you talk about public ownership, you talk about, this economic planning, people would say, hey, don't you forget, like 30, 40 years ago, that the great experiment of decollectivization already proved that those couldn't work, and you have to divide everything to individuals, at least to families, so that the economy can function. And before that, we can't even have enough food to eat. And now, we have, all the great stuff. So that was one of the most frequently cited reference that people use, either from the right wing, and also even among the, let's say, moderately progressive liberals and some, younger generation leftists, and that they would say that's something that we cannot get over with. It's something that you have to show that, there was an alternative at least. So that's how I got interested in this kind of project. So it's more, it's more accidental. It's not something that I planned, but yes, but that's the motivation.
Wonderful. Yeah. That's great. I always appreciate when that sort of goal oriented study of having a question that kind of like irritates you and bugs you, and then you end up diving deep into something in order to learn more about it. That's, I think, the best way to learn in a lot of ways. So I was just thinking we could kind of hop right into the book. You kind of frame agrarian reform in the book globally. So you kind of zoom out from China and you talk about agrarian reform on a global scale. And you kind of basically say that the first, you know, three-fourths or so, or no, is it first, sorry, two-thirds, to be more precise, of the 20th century has a tendency towards, has a tendency against the market, right? So, you know, even something like the New Deal, certainly something like the Russian Revolution, revolution in China, social democracy, and so on, that these things all have a... have, you know, a certain kind of effect, right, against the previous century of liberalism. And then in the agrarian terms, you also have this, you mentioned the Mexican Revolution, Cuban Revolution, agrarian reform all across Latin America and Africa. And of course, the great neoliberal turn kind of changes all this and almost kind of places us, you know, 100 years, you know, in the past in terms of, you know, the global market. So why is it necessary when talking about, you know, Chinese agricultural reform and goings on to have this global perspective? I thought that was a very interesting thing to start off with.
Oh, thanks. It's something that I noticed in people who study China, and also within China. If you read the Chinese literature, you will notice that a very interesting trend. The writings, say before 1990s, you know, it doesn't matter which field you're writing in, literature, philosophy, social science, music, you have a global view. I think that people consciously look at China as part of the global revolution, part of the global history. You know, we're part of that. You know, we are on the same stage with our African brothers and sisters. We are fighting against imperialism, etc. That kind of the world vision was lost after the 1980s, because once you accept the basically American vision of the world, what really matters is the United States. Well, again, plus a few other countries in the OECD, but the third world, the vast majority of the world population became something of secondary or third importance. And they would say, yeah, I know they're poor, you know, like us, but yeah, now we're making progress. And why should we be even paying attention to them and their history or what their struggle have nothing to do with us? And we are unique in the sense that, you know, the kind of Chinese exceptionalism was, I think, consciously promoted since the 1980s. Not so different from the American exceptionalism. You know, it's China would not have this, would not have that. We're gonna get into this very successful path that would revitalize whatever civilization that we have. So that's something that I felt that was needed, desperately needed, for the you know, generations of Chinese leftists after the 1980s episode. And so I wanted to bring this back to the, you know, world historical context, and to argue that, you know, we are not that unique. You know, it's, we might be extreme in a lot of ways, you know, more volatile, oftentimes more violent, but we're doing the same thing. We're fighting the same struggle, and we failed pretty much the same way. So that was my motivation of doing that.
So not to lean into any exceptionalism, but could you describe sort of the process of land reform in China over the course of the revolution? How, you know, you went from this situation where the big landowners owned like 70% of the land to, you know, the final stage of having these people's communes. So the different sort of stages in that, and maybe how it proceeded differently than sort of third world countries that had more populist land reform processes, and from the Soviet Union, where land reform was a lot more, or, you know, land reform proceeded sort of into the net period with redistribution of land, but then the process of collectivization was a lot more forced and ended up with some very tragic consequences. But in China, it happened with a lot more popular support from the peasantry. So could you describe how that happened?
Sure. I think from the 1910s, 1920s, and also partly inspired by the Mexican Revolution and the Russian Revolution, I think the leading activists or revolutionary parties in China had the common understanding that we need to deal with the land question or the peasant question. This was the case with the Communist Party. This was also the case with the Nationalist or the Kuomintang Party. So they had the same understanding. In the late 1920s or 1930s, before the Japanese invasion, overwhelming invasion in the starting from 1937, the communist policy in part of the communist-controlled liberated zones was radical land reform. They basically took land away from the landlords and also the better, you know, well-to-do rich peasants, and redistribute the land, which I think worked well in that circumstance. But as they were defeated militarily later by the Kuomintang government, and they had to do the long march to the northwestern border of China. And then with the Japanese invasion, they started to kind of adopt a more moderate vision of land reform. They say, you know, let's just do rent reduction. The policy at the time was, you know, I think a long-term like a norm in land rent was the primary rent was 50% of the yearly produce. I think this was the case in many parts of the world. And the proposed policy was, let's cut 25% out of that. Now we only charge 37.5% of the yearly produce. And so that policy, I think, persisted for about 10 years, a little more than 10 years, throughout this anti-Japanese war period. And after that, once the Communist Party and the Kuomintang Party get into conflict again after 1945, there, you know, the policy was updated again in certain part of the country. For example, in northeastern part of China, where it used to be the Manchuria, used to be controlled by Japan. When the Communist Party took over, it was relatively easy for them to implement some new radical reform, like just redistribute the land, not the rent reduction stuff. And as the Communist Party expanded the zone from the north northeast to gradually to the south, they step by step introduced the land reform, and which I think many people argue contributed greatly to the eventual military success as the peasants got mobilized in the process. So I think the after 1949, it took only about 2 or 3 years for the Communist Party to implement very thorough land reform in the whole country. And it was also during that period that you see the initial differing opinions within the party leadership. Some people thought this is the end of basically the rural revolution. We're going to focus on the urban sector. We're going to build all the factories. But in the countryside, we should leave it be like this. Yeah, we have millions of small household production. And even if they eventually evolve into some kind of a capitalist economy, we control the urban economy and we have the military. Isn't it easy for us just to take over and then directly transform them into some collective farm? I think they had some memory of the Soviet experiments in the, you know, in that earlier period. And there is other people, other leaders that they prefer to move on from this, you know, do not stop at this small producer economy, but try to promote some cooperation, cooperatives, or even collectives. The debate was already there, and I think starting from about 1953, 1954, the central government in China started to consciously promote cooperatives. The cooperatives is very simple mutual aid, which is a long tradition among the farmers and themselves. I can help you this day, and tomorrow you can help me harvest the farm. The mutual aid team is more like a more formalized way of doing that, formalizing the tradition. But if they move a step further, then they have this very, basic co-ops that we do our work together. It's not like I do yours today and you do mine tomorrow. We as a team, we just do all the things. All the assets we had, all the different lands, or the quality of lands needs to be taken into consideration when we eventually distribute the output. When you do this, the people who are who were well-to-do, who had large animals or happened to be allocated some good land, they were less willing to join such teams because they can do everything just by themselves. And it was until 1955-1956 that Chairman Mao started to, argue that we can move even a step further doing this advanced cooperatives in which you not only work together, your assets or previous assets would also be public, publicly owned. You might get some compensation, but after that it's public. So that's a turning point in this process, which also got a lot of pushback oppositions from the central leadership and also from local leadership as well. So it was a political debate struggle, and Mao basically he won that struggle with his authority. Was implemented basically. Well, it was based on, this mobilization, but still it was based on the central government's direction that, everywhere, whenever possible, develop this advanced cooperatives. And in 1958, here comes this experiment of the People's Commune, which was, I think, was moved beyond production, because the commune was the government. It was modeled after the Paris Commune, that the commune was in charge of everything, production, civil services, the legal system. Everything was combined together into that commune. The previous township or the local government was replaced by that. It was something very new. I think Mao and his allies supported this experiment. That this is the direction for all the cooperatives, which they did very quickly. As I said, it's not about just about production. It's not just about farming. The communes, an important function of those was to develop non-agricultural activities, industrial production. At the time, they get into this all kinds of very basic level industrial production. They also got engaged with massive infrastructure building. They all started with the People's Commune in 1958. So that's, it took, from the party's perspective, probably we'll see, this was coming out of this long experiment that we have done since the 1920s. But for many people in the country that previously was not living under the communist, control, it's probably a 8-9 years process for them to move from the traditional small producer economy to this large scale collective commune. So that's how that process unfolded.
Yeah, so I just want to ask now, kind of, you know, you talk about the communes sort of being a center for so much stuff, and this is a big part of your defense of the commune is the strides they made in healthcare and education, in large infrastructural projects that required, you know, many workers and a good deal of kind of pooled capital and this sort of thing. But I'm kind of curious in terms of the structure of the commune. You mentioned that there's sort of a three layers. There's the production team, the brigade, and then the commune layer. And I was kind of curious if you could go into and kind of talk about exactly what that structure is, and also how direct democracy, and in some cases a lack of direct democracy, played a role in the commune. And, you know, even one thing that always kind of interests me, or does seem rather particular about China, if you read about collectivization in the Soviet Union, very, very bloody process, right? Does not go smoothly. Does not maintain itself very smoothly either. And we had just read for this podcast series, or not this one in particular, but for a Cosmopod episode, we were reading about Yugoslavia, and they had a very similar, they attempted to collectivize agriculture. It didn't really go so well, and they just ended up abandoning it rather quickly. So what was different in China other than having a lot of the support from the peasantry? And how does that translate into the structure of the commune, brigade, production teams, and the commune level structures?
Yes, that's a great question. I don't know if I can provide a comprehensive comparison between China, Yugoslavia, or Soviet Union. But first of all, in defense of the Soviet collectives, I know the process of that, you know, in the 1930s, early 1930s was, as you said, bloody, so very unfortunate. But I think, you know, eventually the Soviet collectives were doing fine. You know, it's in terms of production, in terms of support, even when the Soviet Union had its final, you know, demise, the collective farm workers were still supportive of that collective structure in a lot of cases. You know, they were paid well. The one of the difference between the Chinese commune and the Soviet communes, the farms, was that there is a large urban rural gap between the income or the revenues of the countryside and urban areas in China. It was very, very big, you know. But in the Soviet republics, the difference was little. And in certain cases, in some places, the rural farms, they provide a higher income than average urban workers. The process was not ideal, but at the end, in the 19, you know, when they had the testing day in late 1980s or early 1990s, they were doing okay. In China, the process was a lot smoother. I mean, partly because the Chinese communists learned from the mistakes, some of the problems of the Soviet experience. So they had that in mind, like this is something we wanted to avoid. The Bolsheviks, when they took power, it was primarily based on urban support, the workers. And they had, as we can see from all the writings of the revolution leaders, I mean, they had a natural distrust in peasantry. You know, it's like they're trying to hide the product, that, you know, they're making wine out of all this food. you don't see this kind of sentiment among the Chinese Communist Party leaders, partly because many of them had a peasant background. They spent a lot, probably at least half of their career in the countryside, working with the peasants. So it's a different kind of connection that they have developed. They also wanted to, you know, this was also true with how they worked with the some of the bourgeois leaders in the country. They called them national bourgeoisie. They said, okay, you know, we want to learn from the mistakes in Soviet Union. We want to treat you guys nicely. As long as you work with us. So at least they tried to make it less bloody, let's say. That doesn't mean that, you know, it's always, people didn't have any oppositions. They had oppositions, and there's, you know, people worried whether my animal would become public, and I would lose that animal. And there are reports, again, we're not sure how prevalent those were, but there were reports that peasants would kill their animals beforehand, before the collectivization. You know, they rather eat the meat or sell the meat. But I think, again, I mean, the process was more well thought of, was more well planned in the Chinese case, and it was less coercive. Plus the trust, I think the mutual trust in peasants, from the peasants in the Communist Party, and also from the Communist Party in the peasants, that really helped with the process. It wouldn't be the same if the Communist Party were outsiders. You know, they liberated you and they say, you know, let's just do this. It would be quite different. But in China, a lot of those countries were peasants, or they're from local areas, and they just came to mobilize their friends, their families. That's a different kind of context. So probably that has something to do with this relatively more smooth process.
So you talked about how the People's Communes were sort of the government in the localities in the Chinese countryside. And you said that they, you know, for that reason, were pretty good at organizing, because of their organization, were pretty good at introducing healthcare, education, infrastructure to the countryside, and sort of organizing the labor process to provide those things. Could you go a little bit more into that and talk about sort of the achievements of the People's Communes in those areas?
Yes. In terms of agriculture itself, it's the commune was, you know, overall were very productive. It doesn't matter if you look at the staple foods, like wheat or rice, or you look at this more cash crops, they all had, I would say, very stable, impressive growth in their productivity. Of course, you know, the population also grew at the same time. So the in per capita terms, it didn't grow that much, but it was, you know, it's part of the, you know, the, you know, it's part of the overall story. So, at the same time, they were able to provide a relatively affordable education and health. Every commune, for example, would have at least high school, and sometimes, you know, have more than that, depends on how large you are. And you have every production team would have some kind of, well, if you're a large team, then you have one primary school. And oftentimes the production team is relatively small, so every brigade would have one primary school. That was part of the official kind of guideline. Every village needs to have one primary school. That village that we use nowadays oftentimes corresponds to the brigade in those days. So people had had access to very cheap education. If you talk about the quality of the education, obviously it varied. I mean, there is no steady supply of teachers, to the countryside. So oftentimes the high school graduates from the commune would go to the primary school, you know, can teach the kids. But it's better than before. It's better than, you know, nothing. The education has always been a part of the privilege of the ruling class. So that was really changed a lot of things in the commune and after the commune. In terms of health, the commune provided, again, the financial support for the doctors, the barefoot doctors, and all the basic medical expenses. And again, I mean, if I didn't mention that, you don't have to pay for the much of the education expenses. It's part of your, I mean, you have to pay, but collectively. Medical service is the same. You know, it was nothing fancy. People still, you know, children, young children still die from all kinds of diseases, but it was a dramatic improvement than before. You know, it was that process that trained, I think, a really large group of educators and medical professionals that, you know, later on, they still played, a strong role, even after the commune disappeared. And the commune was perhaps the most, I mean, until this day, the visible legacy of the commune are those huge projects, infrastructure buildings. If you have the chance to visit China, you go to any countryside, you see all those big old buildings. It could be a reservoir, it could be something else, a big bridge. And in most cases, they were built either in the like late 1950s or, you know, late or early 1970s. The commune spent a lot of time on those projects. There is different estimates, but let's say in the traditional society, if you work on agriculture, you probably spend about 130-140 days on the production itself. This was, you know, this is the case nowadays in China. I mean, the peasants spend about 130 days on agriculture. So there's a lot of idle time with the surplus time. The commune basically organized the workers to such an extent that, you know, they often complained, why don't we get any vacation? You know, the only vacation they received was 7 days in 1 year. That was when they had spring festival. So they have to work all the rest days. I mean, if they don't work on agriculture, they work on the infrastructure building process. Again, it's something that it's hard to replicate. The country didn't have much capital, doesn't have you know, all those money. You know, like in the United States, when you build something, you drive all those big machines, Bobcats, Caterpillar, and do all the job just by one single person. If you don't have those and you still want to do it, then you have to mobilize 1,000 people and just do this by hand. And that was basically what happened in the commune. And it worked fairly well. I mean, that's every time when I go back to my hometown, I visit this huge dam in the hills, in the mountains, and it was still magnificent. Even after seeing all those great buildings in Beijing, Shanghai, in United States, it's still something that it's hard to imagine how people did that, actually. You know, it's because it's beyond the imagination, let me say.
That's really beautiful. You know, that's one of the things that I think we do get from actually existing socialism, that it's easy to forget, but there is a lot of collective building that is it's humbling, you know, it's participatory. And, you know, I've read stories, you know, the book we read on Yugoslavia talks about this, work brigades of younger folks, and, you know, all the time you read about this stuff. And it's, you know, the idea of performing labor for something greater than just to line somebody's pockets or just to benefit you or your family or something that really benefits benefits everyone, you know, the entirety of the people. It's a beautiful thing. It truly is.
It is. I just want to add that it is. I mean, when they work on those projects, you do get paid indirectly through your work points. So that has some material incentive in it, but I think compared to the actual work they do, the pay is minimal. I would say it's not something that you can really count on. And people did have this socialist consciousness. You know, I'm not just doing this for myself, because it's the benefits is indirect. It is really something that we're doing for the entire society, for everyone. And sometimes we think that this is obvious. Well, this is ideology, and you just get used to those. But I still remember, when I talked to some of my the members of the village where my family came from, and they still told me at the time that those ideology or those socialist training really had an impact. You know, there were several years when the local government promoted the idea of anonymous heroes, anonymous local heroes, which means that you would secretly do all the good stuff without everybody knowing who you are. And it worked very well, so that, you know, my great-grandmother was at the time, I think, was already 60s or 70s, I mean, who, you know, was never paid much attention to politics. She even got, motivated, mobilized, and she would wake up at 4 a.m., 5 a.m. in the morning and do all the, side job for the commune without, you know, only the family knows, she is doing this. But she really tried to do that. I think there is a lot of things there's a lot of potential, I'd say, in everybody, working people. In under certain circumstances, you have a different consciousness. So that did happen.
That reminds me also of some of the stuff I've read from Che Guevara, talking about, you know, volunteer work and creating the new man and this sort of thing, of a new consciousness. I think that's something to definitely bear in mind. A very interesting thing. So, really quick, just to sort of kind of catch us up. So, people's communes are established in 58. Great Leap Forward obviously coincides with this. There's 3 or so years of famine that ends roughly in 61. So, and you kind of talk about this, that the historical record of the commune or of collectivization is kind of marred by the Great Leap Forward, but that they can be disentangled because the communes continue, the famine doesn't, you know. And so then you have, from 61 to 66, a kind of period of time. And then you have in 66, a declaration of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution by Chairman Mao, which officially ends a decade later in 76. So I kind of hate to skip over that stuff, but I don't want to run too late. You mentioned some really amazing stuff about that period, the Cultural Revolution obviously being something that's a really bizarre incident, one that's really tough to get my mind wrapped around, because I'll read things that seem kind of uniquely inspiring, and then read things that seem uniquely horrific. You know what I mean? And it seems like a period of just extreme chaos. But that ends up kind of resolving when the Gang of Four, Mao dies in 76, the Gang of Four are dismissed, who are sort of the primary supporters of the Cultural Revolution and its continuation. And then finally, you end up with Deng Xiaoping, who comes to power kind of through, from what I've read, kind of an alliance with bureaucratic elements and the new democracy wall kind of movement, which he subsequently totally neglects. once he's in power. So that's kind of a lot of history, but and the communes are existing throughout this entire process. So once you get to 76, 77, 78, what does China look like in the party and in the masses? Are people generally tired of the Cultural Revolution? There's obviously this moment of, there's certain people who want more democracy, the new democracy movement and so on. There's obviously going to be a big window for liberalization, marketization, so on. So what are the ingredients in this, in the big pot that's getting stewed in those years that Deng Xiaoping first comes to power?
Yes. That's a very important but also complicated question. Throughout the Cultural Revolution, which ended several times, it first ended in 1969. That's when Mao said it ended. We had some great success. We're going to do it every 7-8 years. But after Mao died, the post-Mao leadership again said, oh, now the Cultural Revolution ended. it depends on how you interpret those. But throughout the Cultural Revolution, I think there is different, even within the Cultural Revolution, there are different versions of Cultural Revolution. There is the version that was in the mind of Chairman Mao. I mean, he obviously had some grand vision of what is gonna, you know, what is gonna happen in China after he passed away. He basically got the inspiration from, the Soviet experience, that he think that's a dead end. So he wanted to basically revert that course because he saw China was very similar. But on the local level, people didn't quite understand what capitalism was. They didn't have much experience. I mean, they after the land reform, they have limited experience with free market. When they say, this is the revolution is going to stop the capitalist rulers to restore capitalism, they use the slogan without actually knowing much about what that meant. I think that partly contributed to part of the confusion among the local activists when they do it. I mean, they saw a lot of problems with this, Chinese socialist experiments, and many of those didn't fulfill the dreams or the promises in the Communist Manifesto or all the previous revolution writings. So they said this is not right. So there's a lot of grievances, I think, among them to make changes. And that coincided with Mao's call for, this fight against restoration of capitalism. And out of the many activists that I've met or have read, I don't think any of them actually had an idea of what capitalist restoration meant at the time. They only got to know it many years after they got out of jail. So that is that. But out of the concrete grievances they had, there's this inequality between urban and rural. There is inequality between the bureaucrats, the cadres, and normal working people. And within any work units, any companies, any farm, there is this hierarchy. The party committee, then working people. There is all those grievances, and they got a chance to express all those. And in certain cases, they were able to make changes. But in the countryside, for example, they were able to greatly expand medical service and also education. Because again, you get rid of the profit motive, the profit principle, and you get rid of the old, idea of we need to education needs to be, has to follow certain rules, has to have well certified teaching staff, etc. You get rid of those, and you can expand education pretty fast. But there were certain things that they didn't quite change. And I mentioned some of this in the book. You know, in the countryside, in some cases, they interpreted the revolution as factional fights. You know, it's just, I'm this faction and you're that faction. And all of us, I mean, wanted to be in power. Because then, I mean, during the revolution, anyone can be a leader. Right. And if I become the leader, I will really be the leader. That was a great attraction to some of those activists, which they, you know, unfortunately they did, you know, quickly got into this infighting for positions. And the old bureaucrats, when they were swiped away, you know, they just went home. First of all, they still receive wages, you know, the high wages that they used to get. They were not in power, they were not in office, but they had no interest in providing any support or instruction how to run the existing, you know, this machine or this office. And those activists, once they got in power, they quickly realized that I can't just do this by myself. I need some expert to tell me how to do it, how to order stuff, how to supervise, how to instruct. I mean, with enough time of training, everyone can be a president or whatever, but you can't do it overnight. And the bureaucrats basically did this strike saying, okay, you want me to go and you just do it. Then, it caused great trouble for many, and especially with this infighting and all those things. And in a lot of cases, I mean, if you still are concerned with, let's say, production, you're concerned with meeting whatever bourgeois objective that you have, then you have to use the experts. You have to rely on intellectuals. You have to do those. And in one way or another, they were back in power pretty quickly. I mean, that I mentioned some of the examples. I mean, it's like, you know, we'll give you critiques, but after the critic and you're, you know, back in the office and do all the stuff. So I think it was after 1970, gradually, the old bureaucrats, and a significant portion of those already went back to power. That included Deng Xiaoping, the post-Mao leader. And, Chairman Mao was, he was in a very contradictory moment. I mean, he saw the dangers with all those, but he couldn't quite make it work, I mean, using his way. And so he knew that his faction, his allies, were a minority in the central leadership. Despite years of this struggle. So his compromise was let someone like a middle person be the party leader. And there will be a left faction, like Gang of Four, and there will be a right-wing faction led by Deng Xiaoping and his friends. That plan, you know, it was a risky move. He was not sure. I think that was part of the reason that when at the end of his life, when he gave some kind of political will to his allies, saying, you know, you will change, and it could be very bloody, this change. But what can I do? After the passing of Mao, the middle person, this Hua Guofeng, the new chairman. He made a wrong speculation that he thought this, by getting rid of the left faction, he would somehow have more authority over the party, over the old bureaucrats. So he was, I think, with the encouragement from Deng Xiaoping and others, he just arrested the Gang of Four. And at the time, they were all central committee members. This was an unprecedented move in the history of the Chinese Communist Party. This is rare for any Communist Party to solve its own internal debate by making arrests. It's like this. I think it was unprecedented, and the Gang of Four was not prepared. They didn't really anticipate this very dramatic move. But very quickly, I think they were move out of this central leadership. But it took a much longer time for the new leadership to entirely get rid of the pro-Mao faction in the local and provincial level. I think it took about at least 7-8 years for them to entirely get rid of those, because this would include all the cadres promoted during the Cultural Revolution. That was a large number. And many of those had to go through very intense interrogation after 1976 to be cleaned or stay in jail. And there is this repeated campaign against the so-called three kinds of people in the 1980s, and basically to get rid of anyone who have benefited from the Cultural Revolution, who have benefited from following Mao's teaching. So yeah, that process was a bloody process indeed. It's probably more bloodier than the Cultural Revolution itself. So yeah, but after Mao died, the Chinese Communist Party was in this position where the left faction at the central level was eliminated very quickly, and the middle middle person or his faction were quickly marginalized too, and it was that the power eventually moved to Deng Xiaoping. He was he had the close connection with the military. He was also a very seasoned bureaucrat. He was experienced with all kinds of political decision or economic decision process during the Mao era. And no one had more authority than him at that time. And he, naturally he became the one that chosen by that group. And he had, more than anything else, he had the idea of, completely getting rid of the Cultural Revolution or anything related to that. And that's how he started his own program, which eventually led to the decollectivization.
So could you connect, more directly decollectivization to sort of the events you're talking about and then the broader process of market reform in China? Why did the party leadership decide they have to get rid of the People's Communes, and what consequences did this have? What effect did it have on the broader process of reform?
Yes, I think the post-Mao leadership did not, initially didn't think of agriculture or the People's Commune as something that they need to, get rid of, at least not first. They were, at the time, Soviet Union was still there. A lot of, it's, so to them, the, some kind of industrialization, some kind of more so-called modernization that was promoted at the time would be acceptable. And obviously, the look at Japan, look at, other places, I think this was part of the conclusion of the leadership that they, I think it was Deng Xiaoping or someone said, any country that followed the United States got rich, which was largely true in the post-World War II context. And they tried to learn from all those, and they had this strong, I think, idea that you need to get rid of the old planning system that didn't quite work, and they tried to incorporate more, let's say, autonomy in the economy. Maybe partly inspired by the Yugoslavia, but more directly from Japan or Western Europe, that you can do a lot of things with a more decentralized system. And so they did that. They first of all they tried to reduce their planning process. They let individual company to decide how much they want to produce. Well, there is a range, but you can decide how much to produce. And more importantly, you can decide how much income or how much revenue you want to allocate to your own workers. The distribution was allocated, decentralized. And there was this idea that once you start this process, every firm, every company would eventually become independent, and they can even have they can be more efficient. They can even have a little competition, healthy competition. So there was a lot of ideas attached to that policy. But the result of that reform was a very quick failure, because if you give, like this was similar to the Yugoslavia case, where the companies, if they make their own decisions, the employees, the workers would then give us more welfare, give us more bonus. That would cause some immediate problems. The company would have less revenue, less income to make investment. It would also, when the workers get higher income, but without a corresponding increase in the national social output, that you will see a longer waiting line in getting stuff. So that it caused all kinds of problems, including inflation, which was rare for a socialist economy. And, because when you introduce those good things for a capitalist firm, or typical market economy firm to survive, you also need to introduce the discipline. That is, you can fire people. You can make people work more than they should. But that mechanism was not there in China yet. You cannot just discipline the working class. I mean, they're okay if you give them more wages, but it's not okay if you ask them to work more, or accept a lower wage, or even fire them. That's unthinkable. So all the reforms that were eventually, had the idea of introducing those more disciplinary aspects of this reform were faced resistance, very strong resistance by the Chinese workers. I mean, this was just after the Cultural Revolution. It was after the very violent, this period. And the Chinese Communist Party was, they were rightly concerned about what the consequences would be if we just, cannot treat the workers well, if they not happy. So the reform was at a difficult time when they realized that in the countryside the reform can still be done, and even sometimes they can have good results. And then they quickly, I think, shifted the focus to the people's commune and saying that this is the focus of the reform. The communes were easier to dismantle, and different from the factories, where you cannot just do that. There is a lot of communes that were not performing very well, also, so that provided lots of basis for them to do this. I think, from what I understood, although this was cannot be proven, I think there was Deng Xiaoping and his allies. I mean, they had this, they were trying to, plant the seeds from the very early on. Some of the early, pioneers in doing decollectivization, old leaders, happened to be all close friends or close allies of Deng Xiaoping. So my guess was that in the late 1970s, when Deng Xiaoping started to get in power, he basically, this like playing a chess, you go to this province and you go to the other province, and let's see, if I need something, then you can do from there. And that worked out very well in several provinces where he had his close allies. And he then used those as a model, saying, hey, look at that province. They did so well, and all the other provinces should follow. Again, it was a struggle. It was, not every province accepted that instruction willingly. With the central, you know, with this poor decolonization people in controlling the central power, they can easily replace the you know, the opponents. So that's how it was implemented very fastly in the 1980s.
Yeah, so like, you know, you mentioned in the book that there's kind of a fallacy that's often repeated. There's actually, you know, two that you mentioned. So one of them is that decollectivization was both spontaneous and from below. And you challenge both of those ideas. The other is that the boom in productivity or the expansion in production agriculturally after decollectivization or in the transition period is due to decollectivization as such, but you actually point to mechanization, which was a big factor. You mention new hybrid seeds. You mentioned the fertilizer and these other commune era developments, which were really only implemented, say, towards the end of the 70s, and were really, and the results of which you only see kind of during the transition period, rather ironically. And I just wanted to, yeah, to mention those two things, especially the spontaneous character, the voluntaristic nature of decollectivization, and the ways in which that's not exactly true. Also, really quick, want to mention something that I think is just kind of important that was had a big effect on me while reading this, is that the party, for those who wanted to liberalize the market of China, they didn't just go after the workers who had a strong political power base, but went for the peasants initially, which they saw as having a sort of, I guess, like a sort of weaker political commitment than the workers, and were able to sort of lure them down a different path. As you mentioned, and I think this is, you know, something that we have to deal with as socialists, is that the peasants, you know, there was resistance. There was resistance among some peasants, some cadre, and so on. But many of them didn't care one way or the other. And another portion of them wanted what is called the responsibility system, the household responsibility system. And there was enough of them that either didn't care or wanted it to create a plurality towards that direction. But I especially want you to mention or talk about the supposed spontaneity and supposed voluntary commitment by the peasants towards collectivization, because that's, if that's true, it is kind of a damning you know, accusation of against the communes themselves.
Yes, I think the you know, for those of us who are familiar with the at least the history of rhetoric, propaganda of communist movement, there is a, you know, because we believe that there's people that create history, working people, that so the, you know, in tradition, if you want to make a change, at least in the Communist Party, you have to somehow say this was the will of the working people. I didn't impose it. It's there, they're asking for it. And we're just facilitating the change. So there was an old style that you do things. And the thing that everyone fears was, I'm losing the people. If the people don't support me, and no matter what, like what fancy theory you have, you're doomed. You know, this came out of the repeated struggle within the party, like who eventually get the support of the people would win, or they would be correct. You know, the theory itself, if you say, well, I happen to have the support of this Marxism from Das Kapital, great. I also find other sentences from Das Kapital too. So theory is always, messy. You know, they have, each side would have higher intellectuals, Marxists, experts to support them. So eventually on political level, it's who can show that I'm the one that chosen by people. And that was why during this decollectivization campaign, those major, you know, I'd say proponents or the allies were desperate in trying to show that this is something that being asked by people. And if we don't follow that demand, we are making mistakes. Well, in the communist language, you're making left mistakes because you're moving ahead of the people. You have to be with the people. And that's a serious charge in the party. And they, you know, in terms of propaganda, they did that. I mean, they try to portray this was a purely grassrooted, spontaneous move. It's you know, but it's at the same time, you know, they were not, at least at the beginning, they were not shy in admitting that they were very active in promoting that. You know, and it's not a secret that, you know, anyone who disagree with this particular kind of decolonization will have to be removed. There are many ways of doing reforming the commune. You know, you can downsize the commune. You can introduce other mechanism into the commune or do something. And for a short period of time, about several months, I would say, different forms existed in China. So that it seems like the central leadership was okay. Like, okay, just do this and do that. Let's freely explore. But very quickly, and they say, okay, actually only one form that we approve. That is the household reproduction form that, you know, basically is really dividing the entire commune into households. It's you know, even though that was not the most natural or the not even the most popular form, but they clearly, you know, make it coercive, you know, impose it on virtually every part of the country. Only, I think there was only a tiny fraction of local governments were able to resist that. You still see, I guess, I mean, two dozens of communes in today's China, and they are all of them were doing very well. I saw this very interesting study of such a commune in Tibet. You know, it was running very well even until today. And they just, you know, at the end of the year, they do this allocation, piles of cash distributed to every member of the commune. And it was working very well. And it was, they do collective economy, collective production. They took care of the environment as well. So it was, you know, those existed. Those for very special reasons, and sometimes it's very remote. The government didn't really care. Sometimes they had, you know, a strong local leader that, for some reason, was not afraid that can, you know, keep a portion of those. So yeah, there were very like tiny portion of those as exceptions, but most of them couldn't do much. They just follow the orders.
One thing that really interested me about your book is that you conducted a number of oral interviews with peasants in China who had lived under the commune system and then had experienced decollectivization for the later part of your book. I was just interested, could you talk about the process of deciding who to interview, interviewing these people? Do you have any interesting stories that came out of that? That really fascinated me.
I was trained as an economist. You know, normally anthropologists or sociologists would do oral interviews. I don't have much training in that. But at that moment, I felt I needed a lot of, you know, local knowledge to understand a lot of things, questions that I had. And also, you know, what you get from the existing writings are sometimes abstract. You don't quite get to know what was the problems in the commune, for example. I mean, you don't trust the right-wing stuff, but you have to understand from a working people perspective. So that was why I just went to do the interview. It was close to my hometown. And I have friends and family members that introduced me to some other friends or members, and then introduced me to others. And So then I stayed in a village. It's I don't know, a local elite in the village. I mean, he was well-to-do. He was an artist under the commune, a good music performer. After the reform, he became a well-to-do business person and also a successful farmer. Yeah, so I stayed at his place and he introduced me to a lot of things. And I, using his home as a base, I just walked and visited all the families in the village and the nearby villages. The people that I can really talk to were the older people. The younger people, they either, you know, they have work to do, they are working in the big city, so they're not home, or they don't have much knowledge about that period at all. So I try to talk to those who had some expensive knowledge about that period. And I was impressed by a lot of those people. I think they had, you know, even though they didn't have whatever Marxist training or academic training, they had a pretty good idea what happened. You know, was one Smith person in the village who make all those agricultural tools, and he said, you know, he's the son of the big landlord in the region before the revolution, and obviously his family were all, you know, his assets were all taken away. But he said, I had no zero resentment. You know, this is part of class struggle, and we have to get rid of this. So I support that, even though he said, I personally always suffer from this. But, you know, this is the right thing to do. He said, you know, even though it was relatively harder for him under the commune, in the Mao era, he got more comfortable financially after the market reform. But it's still, he would say that, you know, even though, you know, maybe the commune had mistakes, Mao made mistakes, he was, you know, making mistakes for us. So it's a different kind of thing. And he is that, you know, he had high respect, you know, it's the traditional way of, you know, showing respect is said, you know, Chairman Mao is from the sky, you know, a pop, one of the stars. And Deng Xiaoping, even though he was, you know, he eventually got power, he's not like a rat, you know, it's a traditional way of condemning, praising people. And they also told me all kinds of things about, you know, the complaints that they had in the commune, which were very helpful to me, because I, you know, oftentimes don't hear much of those from their perspective. They complain they work too much. That's something that really, you know, I said, why don't we just, you know, can we do the collective again? Can we do the commune again? They said, that's so tiring. I mean, it's not a matter of like, you know, it doesn't work, it's not efficient, but it's just too much work for them. I you know, as I mentioned, they don't have much break, right? I mean, they, compared to what they receive, they really made a lot of sacrifices. But I think it was particularly painful for them, for all of us, to see what they sacrificed for, what they built. Eventually, you know, were appropriated by some others, you know, as some quick profits. So that's something that they felt very sad. They also felt powerless. You know, what can they do? I talked to some of these local party leaders in the villages. I attended the meetings. They have regular local meetings where this village party members or the local villagers can attend. Talk about what's happening at the central committee level, you know, what the meeting was about and what we should do and all the local stuff. And if you go talk to them saying, you know, do you think, you know, this household production is a way to go? And they would probably say no. You know, it generated so many problems. It's just on the very concrete level. I mean, if you do the agricultural production, you need irrigation. And lots of those, I mean, most of the irrigation were built during the Mao era under the commune. And the irrigation system need maintenance. Without the collective, who is going to do those maintenance? So very quickly, the local irrigation system was basically became obsolete. You still see the large irrigation system. That's because it's large. They still work. But the local ones, you know, bring water from the large aqueduct to the local farm, like a small farm, that is a lot more work. Previously they use human labor to do it. Nowadays, if you do it, you have to use money. But who would give you money? Even in that village that I visited, they said, at least it take $1 million, well, million Chinese yuan to do this project. But where can they find that 1 million Chinese yuan? It's impossible. So they said that this small household production has very obvious problems. But what is the alternative? If I ask them, like, can we still do collective production? You know, they would say if possible, they want to do it. You know, there is no like very clear, like, oh, we don't want to do it. We don't want to go back to socialism. For the peasants, many of them, this was not a question. The question is, who is going to lead us to do it? I mean, you need leadership. This is something that they really emphasize. I mean, you need this overall social environment for it. You need this leadership to do it. To build such collective anywhere, right? Build a co-op, you need the leadership to make a lot of sacrifice. Basically, you need to do a lot of work, unappreciated, unpaid. But who is going to do that in the contemporary period? I mean, that's something that they often talk about. It's not that they are anti-collective. It's that once you remove the collective, once you already break the organization to individual atoms, you need some dramatic effort to rebuild that kind of thing. But it's not easy to do so under the current, economic social institutions.
So I think we should probably maybe I've got like one more question, and perhaps Matthew, if you do as well, and then we can close her out. I think one of the things that I find important about Cosmonaut is thinking kind of strategically about history and what it can show us. So the parts of your book that I was most excited by were the specific critical aspects with regards to the commune and things that you see as potential historical solutions and solutions for today. So like one example you mentioned, which definitely tickled my ears, was the Worker Peasant Alliance, something you also find in the Soviet Union initially, and something that being a big kind of Bukharin fan made me very happy to see, as he was the primary defender of this alliance in the Soviet Union. And another thing that I was really impressed on is the doubling down on plain and simple democracy, that without democracy and without accountable, transparent leadership, there's going to be issues. And you mentioned there was, even though there were democratic mechanisms in the commune, there was also a lot of mechanisms of selection by the party alone. And it definitely seems to me that the more you're able to allow the people, the laborers, to elect their representatives to decide what work they want to do within the reason of the general framework of the plan, the more of the spirit of socialism there is, because it's the spirit of worker self-activity as much as possible. There's obviously always going to be constraints. And one of the constraints that you mention is expertise. You have one guy in the village who, is an expert on something. And so, or a particularly good leader or something. And you mentioned several instances of sexual abuse as a result. I mean, if you're the only person if you have a monopoly on a particular skill and you know it, then why not do something foul? Why not, for instance, kill your wife, which is one of the examples that you mentioned. And obviously, under socialism, we want to abolish any possibility for people to use power in such a way as to negatively influence or dominate or coerce other people in that sort of way. So I thought that was very interesting, and I was also curious if you had seen this article of the and I know I'm going to butcher this name, but Zhuzhuang People's Commune. I'll put it in the chat, but it's apparently a commune that's ongoing. One of the very few that totally maintained its structure through the tempest of marketization. There's an article in the Monthly Review on it, which I should also mention is the publishing company which released your book. And we're big fans of the Monthly Review, so I have no qualms with giving them a big shout out. But yeah, I'm just curious if your thoughts on that, and what are the possibilities moving forward in China on the peasant question?
I agree with you that there was a lot that to be done. I mean, when you build up such communes, it would be ideal, obviously, if the communes had all the things that we wanted from a commune. But in a lot of cases that it didn't. Despite all the hopes that the actual communist revolution didn't take place in the more advanced part of the world, didn't succeed in Western Europe or United States, where a lot of such things would be easier to manage. So, where you have everyone would have a better education, have more training in all kinds of things. So yes, that would be ideal. But I think the history does show that the revolution at least first took place in relatively poorer places like Russia and China, and that obviously it was the weak link. It was the weak link that was easier for you to make a revolution, to overthrow the old ruling class. But it was also the weak link that eventually means that you have to, besides building, let's say, a more egalitarian democratic society, you also have the, obligation of developing industry, doing all those sort of things. And a lot of cases that you were repeating part of the history in capitalism in Russia and in China in different forms. But there's as you mentioned, when not everyone have the same kind of knowledge or expertise, then there will be hierarchy, there will be differences. That person would have more power. Even if you say it on paper, everyone is equal, but in practice, we know that is not the case. So yeah, then that was part of the thing that in Cultural Revolution, they say, we should attack the bourgeois rights, but we know that you cannot just attack bourgeois rights so that it would disappear. In order for all the things that to work as we want, we would need everyone to have a fairly good level of understanding, let's say, writing or math or many, scientific knowledge, which this pre-existing socialist society did a great job in providing those. So I think, but at the same time, it has all those pre-existing conditions. It was the weak link. I think in China, even after Mao passed away, there is still millions and millions of peasants who got very minimal level of income, and if you offer a opportunity to work in the capitalist sector in the urban area, it would be natural for people to go. Yes, the commune is great, but that job in capitalism offer a better compensation. I think that's, it's part of the, you know, so the weak link for the old ruling class also partly became the weak link for socialist construction. I mean, as Marxists, we can only say that, you know, no matter, you know, how we look at those, eventually, even in countries like Russia or China, the conditions are getting better. I mean, nowadays, there is urbanization has greatly expanded. Generations of people have got, I would say, a fairly amount of education. So let's say if today we're going to do this kind of thing, we would have we'd be much better prepared, let's say. and that would give you more confidence. It could be, you know, could be out of a revolution. It couldn't be out of something else. But I'll be more confident in the current historical moment if we review this communist socialist project worldwide. It's more difficult, let's say, for capitalists to defeat us. That's what I wanted to say. Yeah, it's easier for us. It's harder for them.
So one final question I had is the subtitle of your book is How China's Peasants Lost Collective Farming and Gained Urban Poverty. And there's not a ton about the urban poverty aspect of that in the book. So I'd be interested in you expanding on sort of what the fate of these peasants that experienced decollectivization is, you know, what the sort of urban poverty looks like. And then you also say at the end, that the future of the class struggle in China is more of a worker story than a peasant story. And so just if you could talk about what you see as sort of the prospects for that are and how it should relate to the agrarian question and the situation in the countryside.
Sure. Since the 1980s, I mean, after the decollectivization reform, most of the social struggles, class struggles that we have seen took place in the cities, and it was a long process. Even today, I mean, the privatization project in China has not finished. It's still going on, so that's why I think, you know, the future struggles will be more likely related to the urban struggles, to worker struggles. A lot of those peasants, and now I don't know the number this year, but in 2020, because the situation was different, but in 2019, I think was about 300 million workers that they migrated from the villages to the cities. And that was, you know, become a major part of the urban working class. And this people, you know, they didn't get, very few of those, I mean, maybe less than 1%, would have the opportunity to work in a more formal sector. Most of them would end up in an informal sector, doing all kinds of jobs. If you look at the formal sector employment, starting from the late 1990s until now, I think it has shrunk by about 50 million jobs, and it has never recovered. So the formal sector never expanded after that, and it's you know, only a very select few can get and enter that sector. Others would have to end up with this kind of long working hours, harsh working conditions, and an okay pay. You know, an okay means it's not a living wage, but it's probably more than what they get from agriculture production. But again, considering the other expenses they have to incur, you know, the living in the city, raising children in the city, and those would that would cost a lot of money. So it's hard to say they already out of poverty. I mean, I know that the Chinese government has been promoting this anti-poverty program in recent years, and it was claimed that, you know, it has achieved that goal. And a lot of those poverty programs, I think, were targeting the remote rural areas, which definitely, I mean, there are many poor people living there. So I think that's, you know, it's important they provided support. But those people who work in the city, well, mostly live in the city, they are also very poor. They don't have a stable job, and they don't have the easy access to, let's say, cheap food or something compared to people who, you know, live in the villages. So I think it's that a large part of those poverty, urban poverty, were hidden and didn't quite get noticed. And also it remains to be seen how this rural urban migration would end, how they would end, because if those cities provide, let's say, permanent residence to those rural workers, it would more or less would incur a significant social welfare payments, you know, even if it's minimal, but it's still, I mean, with a large number, they still need to do that. And I don't know how willing or how capable they would be to providing peasant worker that. And also, you know, once you settle down, you have different set of considerations. I mean, a large reason that we don't see that much, like very strong will or militancy from the rural working class to fight was because they look at themselves as like, I'm just here for a few years, I'm leaving. I don't see that much point in doing the struggle here. But once they really settle down, if the country really wants to transform them into urban residents, that would be a different story. That, you know, this become my hometown, and I would be much more willing to do the struggles that I previously maybe not willing to do. So I think that we're going to see some much more militant actions from that part of the working class when we, you know, if the urbanization, you know, continues.
All right. Well, this has been so much fun. What a very fun conversation. And I think this will be the first Cosmopod dedicated to China as well. So I think we really hit it off right.
Thank you. It was great talking to you both. It's always great to discuss Marxism revolution with comrades. thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. It's an absolute pleasure.
Me too.
All right, comrades and friends, thus concludes our interview with Jun Zhe. I hope you enjoyed it. He is the author, again, of From Commune to Capitalism, and that is on the Monthly Review Press, so I highly recommend you purchase that book, as well as just mill about on their website, because the Monthly Review has a lot of great stuff, and they're certainly an influence on Cosmonaut. I would also recommend that you become a patron of our Patreon. At $2 a month, we've recently expanded our Discord. So if you give us $2 a month, you can join our Discord and you can chat and talk with a bunch of really smart communists, a lot of people who are a hell of a lot smarter than me and from whom I've learned a great deal. So I would highly recommend you do that. It's a great resource. Furthermore, at $10 a month, you can join our reading group, which we're getting started back up. And we'll be reading Cosmonaut articles. We'll be reading books that have influenced the project, I should say. And I would love to see you there reading along and chatting and discoursing. And we're also going to continue doing these interviews, which I take a great deal of pleasure in doing. And it's going to help us overall dig into the guts of our history, our collective history as socialists, understand the tragedies, understand the victories, and also it helps us ask the right questions for the future. So I do hope that you continue listening, and thank you so much for listening so far.